the topic that I've set on sharing some thoughts with you this morning is a look at what the Bible has to say about eunuchs, and then to ask some questions about what consequences the way the Bible deals with this category has for how we think about gender identity, sexuality, and themes related to it. It's a topic which I think has a lot of sensitivity and attention in our moment in history. In some ways, it's a topic where one feels skittish not to step on toes, but at the same time, it's one which is really existential in a personal way for all of us, because we breathe the air of our moment in history, and so our own sense of being and identity and how we situate ourselves does not stand loose. You know, it's not a kind of us and them in this moment in history. Thinking about, the difficult and more complicated identity themes is very much a personal thing. It's something that has to do with all of us, I think, in our moment in history. There we go. So, eunuchs, historically seen, the eunuchs in biblical times were, for the most part, two categories: people that had been castrated or had their gonads damaged. It's a rather graphic thought, but for the purpose of having somebody look after their harem, for example, so that they wouldn't be a threat to the women there, or those who were born with, and then it becomes much less clear exactly what the term eunuch refers to, born with an inability to procreate in some way, shape, or form. So it's a fairly, broad category, actually, even in the Old Testament. I'm going to say, just in one slide, how we have come to our thwarted moment in history, a kind of snapshot, a philosophical snapshot. Now, I'm aware that many of us don't process our lives philosophically. I happen to be philosophically interested in some, it's something that matters to me as to what has shaped the ideas of our culture to bring us to this moment. And, I could go much further back, but I'm just going to start with the Enlightenment. So 300 years in the making, this moment in history, our moment in history. In the Enlightenment, there was a skepticism towards given reality. I think it was the first time that skepticism was so explicit. And it had the form of doubting one's own existence. How can I be sure that I exist? So rather than accepting it and taking it for granted that you exist, and then looking left and right at the rest of reality, what I would call the created order, people asked themselves the question, and this is fundamentally skeptic, how can I know whether I exist? And René Descartes is famous for having said, I'm busy doubting that I exist. Doubt is a thought process, so cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Doubt is a thought process, so I must exist. And it seemed like an interesting thought experiment, and one which would provide a kind of foundation for all sorts of other things. But in all honesty, this was an insidious time bomb under the thought of the Western world. Everything that's been influenced by the Enlightenment having chosen to really doubt given reality, and there where you can have lots of criticisms about medieval thought, etc. But by and large, society accepted what was given and tried to figure out what they thought about it. And for the first time, you get a really explicit philosophical articulation of doubting that which is given. And yes, there were some Greek philosophers who did their best shot at it, but they didn't have this broad sweeping cultural impact. The Enlightenment seems to somehow have impacted our society broadly. Now, this goes on and expresses itself more sharply in empiricism. People like John Locke, maybe David Hume could be included, where they focus on our sense data, the things we see, smell, hear, as information that, yeah, we would hope informs our view of reality, but they risked having it define reality. They were so strongly formulated, maybe in the vernacular of this earlier Enlightenment thinking, the method, meta hodos, according to a set out path, the method to get knowledge and truth was according to a certain set of rules, and the empiricists said you need to use sense data, empirical data, and on that basis establish your sense of certainty. And the problem with this is that rather than having reality just be itself and us getting to look left and right, we've taken this position of putting the human mind in the center of the universe and funneling stuff through our heads and only accepting that which comes out. Which I think is an overestimation of our place in the universe. We're just one part. The Creator made it all. And we are one piece of reality. Reality cheerfully goes its own way, whether we do something or not. Acknowledging that fact, that there's a hard fact outside of us, outside of our head, is important. The rendition of reality is not only on the screen of the projection of my mind. And empiricism was risky in this regard. Now, it got even, let's say, deeper and shakier in the age of Romanticism. And we must think the end of the 1700s, begin 1800s. This was a time when sentiment became center stage. And when we started to doubt our empirical sense data and to look for an alternative source of certainty. And this source was found in the way we feel about things, our emotional experience. Romanticism, one would have to take a lot more time to exactly tease out what the romantic is in Romanticism, but it is much more based on how we emotionally feel about reality. And really, there where the empiricists used empirical sense data to authenticate reality, the romantics used emotional experience. Something was real if it gave you a certain gut response. And in the end, that view starts to mess with our view of how everything has come about. For example, evolutionary thought, which was born in the Romantic era, the second half of the 1800s, basically says that biological urges, the kind of butterflies in your stomach urges, those are defining for reality. They create life and propagate it and so forth. It's all from that emotional gut response to reality. The age of sentiment. And then in the 20th century, we could have many more data points, but existentialism says, no, actually it's my choices that define reality. Not just what I feel, but what I choose. And in this, you already taste the shifting tide, giving up on whether we can actually establish a reality outside of us. Maybe the only reality that matters is the one that we are projecting. And I should say a lot more about existentialism, but I don't have the time. Anyway, closer to home, to our own moment in history, postmodernism has been deeply influential. And there's a strange thing. We call it postmodernism. Well, I think this Enlightenment thought is modernism. Postmodernism would make you think that we'd moved beyond it. But in some ways, we haven't. You see, what happened here is that we put the human mind in the center. And first we used reason and sense data and then experience and emotional experience and finally the choices that were produced here. And in the postmodern era, rather than take the mind out of the center, on the basis of having the mind in the center, we said, therefore there is no ultimate reality outside of me. It's just what I mix together. And that's as good as it gets. There's no given reality. It's all a social construct motivated by power dynamics. That really is maybe it's slightly cynical, but a summary of what many of us find taught in very ritzy universities in the world today. If you're doing gender studies at any number of colleges in the world today, this is the basic underlying assumption that it's all a social construct. While I was listening to various podcasts and lectures on this topic over the last week, I was listening to Abigail Favala speak at Harvard, and she asked people, what is gender in the class? And first there was a long silence because everybody sensed that it was very risky to say anything.
Yeah.
You put yourself out on your own. And so she really had to sort of pull some teeth to get them to. And one guy in the back of the classroom said, well, obviously the correct answer is that it's a social construct. It shows you how forceful this narrative is at our moment in history. It's just a social construct. And that this leans against a realist view of maleness and femaleness, you know, having some kind of reality in the world. It's just something that's been constructed. Now, seeing that we're in a moment in history where the gale force wind of culture is pushing us very rigorously with 300 years of momentum in a specific direction and one which leans against taking given reality seriously or letting it have a part in being defining, it's got to be challenging to hear people, somebody like me, articulate their thoughts on the presupposition that given reality is actually important. Because that really is my starting point. I'll be up front. I'm somebody who believes that there's a created order, that there's a God who made what's out there, and that we are part of this greater creation. Came across David Malone. He was in Norway adjudicating a debate. He's an interesting guy. He's done a lot of science documentaries for the BBC. And he said the following. I thought it was really a nice, crisp articulation. He said, I think people accept or reject an idea based on what they think the collateral damage to the rest of their worldview will be. It's quite a telling formulation. If you accept an idea, sometimes you find that idea forces you to give up another idea. You're really not happy about giving up. And I think this topic, of all the topics that one could be busy with at the moment, this is one of those topics where we feel that giddy feeling of, and what's my conclusion going to mean for all sorts of other things I believe about the world and about myself? And a lot of convictions in the Western world. are up for grabs when one asks some fundamental questions on the topic of gender. Professor Anil Seth from the University of Sussex writes, we are not computers made out of meat. Our minds do lots more than just process data. They are filled with light and color, with shade and shape. We experience the world around us and, the important detail, being a self within that world. And he's busy with the philosophy of mind, thinking about consciousness and what it is to be a conscious being. And just before these words, he told of his own experience of having anesthesia and coming out of it, and how fundamentally different than sleep that experience was. And he articulated this way. He said, I could have been out for 5 minutes, half an hour, or 50 years. I didn't know. At the moment of coming out of that anesthesia moment. Our minds are amazing. They do, let's say, give us a multicolored, depth-filled perception, but not just processing impulses from outside. We experience the world and ourselves being in that world in a specific way. And our gendered sensibilities are part of that experience. Now, one more quote from the philosophy of mind and then I'll move on. If you're talking about consciousness, you've just stumbled on one of those areas. Oi, Hans, welcome. you've stumbled on one of those areas of life where science still has many question marks and is not agreed. There are many different theories out there as to exactly what consciousness is and how it might work. But we are very far from articulating some sort of mathematical formula for this thing that we call consciousness. We just have theories, and some of those theories are completely opposing, are not in agreement with each other. And so, to assert that our sense of self is part of this dilemma means it's an area that's tricky. It's hard to grasp, and we need to be honest about this when we're thinking about gender. That there's a lot of not knowing about exactly how this thing works inside of us. We shouldn't pretend too much in the realm of certainties on this score. Thomas Nagel, a philosopher of mind, says, for a conscious organism, there is something that it feels like to be that organism. And it's made up of a whole myriad of perspectives, including things that have to do with sexuality and gender. Now, as I'm transitioning here, I say, part of how we feel about ourselves is undeniably influenced, maybe even shaped, by how other people respond to us. And you can assert this about how little people discover that they are people. And you can assert this as to how we feel about ourselves as we sit here today now, as adults, or as teenagers. If you think in terms of little people, I'm fond of a piece of thought by a Dutch philosopher called Henk Geertsma. He articulates a part of this in a book called Homo Respondens, where he says the second person perspective is not sufficiently appreciated We're forever talking about first and third person in the Western world. How objective or subjective is your knowledge? Are you, you know, does it with a first person or a third person perspective? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the view from nowhere, or are you personally involved? But we skip over the second person perspective. The second person perspective is the hey you moment. Hey you! And you whip your head. You haven't yet figured out whether you think that person exists. You haven't yet figured out whether you want to respond, but you're responding to an impulse from outside. The call and the response, that's the second person zone. And, you know, little babies, when they are born, may not be very self-aware. They wave their arms around, etc., but they aren't necessarily saying, I wonder what I want to do. I think I want to touch this thing that's hanging above me. They wave their arms around just enough that at a certain point they bump into this rattle that their mum has hung above their bed, and they realize, my gosh, that's me. It's a discovery. And the same can be said of on the objective. So the subjective side of things is not so primary, but also not the objective. They look at you, they look away, and they're not thinking, I wonder what she's doing. No, they look back and they're a little startled that you're still there. They slowly discover that the world is is cohesive and sort of solid outside of them. It's a discovery. But from the very start, they respond to their mother or father who's goo-goo-gaga-ing them, who's treating them like a person. And I think for a lot of our sense of being persons, which is so much deeper and fuller than just our perspective of what gender or you know, sexuality we have, it's something we receive from the people around us. But there is also a clear interplay between how we represent ourselves and how people respond to us. And if this were the whole of the narrative, these two statements, we'd be stuck in little catch-22, a little circular or something. But I think, given reality, steps in and demands its piece of our attention. There is something deeper that has always been primal in how we establish our perceptions. And this has to do with biological potential. I'll argue my case with a little quick internet example. Let's see. Oh, I may be offline at the moment. Oh, no, I'm not. Look at that. This was an article which had the title, Men or Women, Who's Really Checking Out Your Boobs? A little bit naughty title to this article. They used eye-tracking technology on a sample of men and discovered they spend more time looking at our breasts and hips than our eyes. Who's surprised? But here's the interesting part. The sample of women who also took part in the experiment stared at other women's breasts for just as long as the men. Yep, we women are just as interested about what's going on in the chest region as our male counterparts. Now, there have been endless studies of this sort. They put special glasses on and see where people's eyes go, etc., etc. It shouldn't surprise us. You see, it's very natural to try to check who is it that I'm interacting with at the, you know, at the level of which sex am I dealing with. Yeah. It's a biological given. It's pretty much hardwired in how we approach each other. It is this biological potential factor which is, it's quite significant. Abigail Favala, whose book I'll refer to later on, also highlights the realm of biological potential. And she articulates it even more specifically, the potential for motherhood or fatherhood, in the biological sense, as being quite significant for what it is to be a man or a woman. Now, maybe the theme of biological potential, more than any other aspect of this issue, explains the persistent sense of cognitive dissonance when there is a mismatch between someone's inner experience of gender and the bodily potential they represent. And this is true for people internally. It gives stress. That's the unsalted truth. Gender dysphoria gives stress. But it also is messy for the interaction with other people, and often leads to frustration or even aggression in the way people respond. And this is the moment when I segue to the eunuch and what the Bible has to say about the eunuch. Eunuchs will have suffered from this kind of mismatch between biological potential and body plan and how people responded to them. You see, for a eunuch, one of the hard parts of their reality is that biological potential for offspring cannot be realized. And if that plays such a large role in the hearts and minds of people, that's got to be a complicated thing to carry, to situate. Think of the castrati in our even recent European history. We had people who were castrated in their youth, boys especially, for the sake of maintaining a high voice. Teaches us something about what happens if you're castrated, namely that the androgens don't do their work and so some bodily changes don't take place. It's something which is noticeable from outside. So to be a eunuch, in many cases, is also a visible identity. It's something people perceive when they interact with you. There's sometimes less testosterone-impacted physique visible. Somehow people often knew they were dealing with a eunuch when they saw one. It was an identity. And a tricky one, I might add. And society had that awareness. Now, the first text I'm going to look at with you is Isaiah 56, verse 1 to 8. And if one wants to use the predicate wonderful, this is a wonderful text. And in some ways, I can't say it without feeling somewhat emotional, because of how much it must have meant to people who wrestled with this complicated identity. Isaiah has many wonderful passages, but this one surely is especially notable. So Isaiah 56 verse 1, this is what the Lord says: maintain justice and do what is right. It's like universal advice for all of us, right? For my salvation is close at hand, and my righteousness will soon be revealed. And he's asking us to look at reality with a sense of future and of God's having all of history in his hand. Blessed is the one who does this, the person who holds it fast, who keeps the Sabbath without desecrating it, and keeps their hand from doing any evil. Having a sense of good. And then he applies it. He says, let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people. See, there were places in the Old Testament when it said that foreigners were not allowed to enter the temple. Deuteronomy, we have such a text. And let no eunuch complain, I am only a dry tree. I can't have offspring. And why not? Why is this prophecy in Isaiah going to say that a eunuch should not do that? And I think it's very important. 4. This is what the Lord says. To the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what pleases me.
That means keeping their hands from doing evil.
Who choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant. To them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that will endure forever.
It's a magnificent promise, exactly where the point of pain might first be felt, in that of potential. I will give them an everlasting name that will endure forever. Future directed. Something better than sons and daughters. And something that has to do with name. You know, we often connect our sense of name as something that is passed on through the generations. And in our neck of the woods, we happen to name people through the masculine line more frequently. So if you don't have sons like me, you could have anxiety about your name being lost, which a lot of people have had, that kind of thing. I have to tell you, I was rather relieved when I had daughters. I have five sisters, and it's sort of what I'm used to. I'm rather happy with my daughters. But let's be honest, I have offspring. At least I have the potential to have it, and I've actually been blessed with children. But God is talking here to a group that cannot have children, by definition not. And he says to them, I'm going to give you something better than sons and daughters. I'll give you an everlasting name. I'm going to give you an identity, and here it comes, an identity that is made safe, that is significant, that's eternal, that lasts. This reference to name is really, really important. I will give an everlasting name that will endure forever.
There where precisely this thing, the identity issue, might be thwarted, he says, I've got your back. And we can read a number of things out of this. First of all, this little reference here, I will give within my temple and its walls. Why is that so significant? Because in Deuteronomy 23, no one who has been emasculated by crushing or cutting may enter the assembly of the Lord. So you had, in the symbolic cultic practices, a kind of role play demonstration of God's purity, etc., in the assembly, you had a text which would have been a painful one to bear for anybody who was a eunuch. And they may have been, by ill understanding, people not correctly respected. And God makes unequivocally clear here in Isaiah, as he points towards also the fulfillment of Christ, I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name, an identity better than sons and daughters. So, it's interesting. He's acknowledging the identity dilemma. He's acknowledging the impact on offspring and everything that's connected to that. The Bible is not in denial about these things. It's inviting this into the temple. And it's looking for a solution with an eternal perspective and not fully in the here and now. I think that part is difficult for our moment in history. We're arguably the culture that wants instant gratification for just about everything, including with issues of identity. And so to have a promise given which is future directed is something we find hard. Now, before I go to some other texts in the Bible. I want to say a few things about this book of Abigail Favala, The Genesis of Gender. She has a Roman Catholic background, herself having done gender studies, been in a rather feminist context, had her own disquiet about identity, etc. Very well positioned to reflect on the topic from within, and a book well worth reading. She, on the one hand, does a good job of articulating how the emphasis on gender in distinction to sex, how that came about in the Western world. So it's actually quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And she also provides an interesting look at analysis of Genesis 2. She doesn't look at too many other biblical texts, though. One of my reasons for reflecting on some of these texts on the eunuch. Simone de Beauvoir, in 1949, wrote, "One is not born, but rather becomes a woman." And arguably, this is one of the first moments when the idea of gender, and the gendered sense of being a woman, stood loose from a given body plan at birth. It's quite recent in history, if you think that's, roughly 1950. This only becomes really very explicit in the 1970s. This is when John Money is busy working as a psychiatrist. He's the one that coined the term gender role. You know that didn't exist before the 1970s? Gender role? The term doesn't get used. So it's a very recent phenomenon to think in terms of gender roles. And I think we should ask some critical questions. Mm-hmm. Whether, it makes it sound like we're playing a role rather than being. While most of the time, as we get on with life, it's a matter of being. It's something we don't think about if we're in a good mood and not too self-conscious. Now, John Money is a rather interesting case. He got to be called in as a psychiatrist when there was a boy who'd suffered from genital mutilation because of circumcision that took place. And he had these theories about gender being a social construct. And the boy happened to have a twin who was also, in the picture. And he chose to advise the parents to let further surgical procedures be done and to raise this biological boy as a girl. And in many ways, it's a kind of experiment on John Money's part, because you have, a biological twin and, his theory that it was a gender construct. I think, looking back over time, one can be deeply critical of what happened here, not in the least, because, some of the stuff he did on the way in terms of trying to socialize the one as a girl and the other as a boy, included letting them sort of look at and take positions in terms of their genitals and differences, etc. And ultimately, I think it was in 2004 that the boy in case committed suicide.
Yeah.
And a couple of years later, his brother also did. So it's a very tragic outcome. But he was quoted endlessly. You know, there's a long distance between 1970 and the 2000s. And so he had a huge, huge impact. Evidence the fact that we use the term gender role so broadly. I think if you want to look for reasons for why sense of gender is so complicated in our moment in history, Favala, I think, is quite right when she says that hypersexualization and the internet seem to be fueling the phenomenon, providing an excellent, if depressing, insight into what it can be like to be a teenage girl today. And that's the fact that more teenage girls want to express as the other gender than any other category. And it's really tough. Let's be honest. It's really tough in a moment in history like ours to be a teenage girl, where there are messages on every page and everywhere that you're a sex object, in a society that seems to have legitimized this way of looking at women. And yeah, I really should be doing a lot more thinking about hypersexualization and the role that the internet is playing. If you're in my line of work, talking to people, and especially to lots of young men, it will not be a surprise to you that maybe a majority or most men in our day wrestle with pornography.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
And that's really, a rather depressing insight into it's a footnote to a really problematic moment in history. And maybe some of the disquiet that is felt and the pressure that is felt by many a young woman has to do with a society that's a little messed up on this score. So, I'm going to jump to a New Testament passage in Matthew chapter 19, where our Lord Jesus actually hearkens back to the category of the eunuch and expands the application of thinking about the eunuch. It's really interesting. He's talking about marriage, and then he references eunuchs, but he does so in a way which actually enlarges its application, which makes me free to feel free to do likewise. So Matthew 19, verse 10, the disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it is better not to marry." This is after he's told them that, you know, actually divorce was not intended and that you were meant to be partner for life. And they think, this is too hard. And Jesus replies, verse 11, "Not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For," and here we come, here it comes, "there are eunuchs who were born that way." The category of people who cannot procreate because they have an XXY chromosome or something like that. "For there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others," people who have been castrated in some way or other. "And there are those who choose to live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it."
It's an amazing last sentence here. Mm-hmm. He understands it's a little complicated. And he's saying, you know, embrace this understanding if you can. Not expecting too much from us. But what he's done here is he's in a world where marriage doesn't really work for everybody, and apparently that was the case already in the time of Christ. It's not just our own moment in history where, yeah,
there seem to be a lot of, for example, single women in the church who would love to have been married but aren't, because there's a numeric deficit of men, for example, in the church. That's the truth. That's statistical fact, not fiction. So he's elaborating this category of people who in some way feel not connected to the potential of offspring. And he doesn't only leave it with the ones who have it physically, but also those who choose, in this case, for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. But I think it allows for me to think of the promise that Isaiah makes in the Old Testament as something which is applicable in this more broad fashion. That's really interesting. Looking at Jesus' ministry, this piece of scripture seems to have been important in his psyche. If you look at Mark chapter 11, from verse 15 onwards, you read the following. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. This is arguably one of Jesus' most emotional moments in his ministry. This is pretty raw and forceful. Much discussed by people. But guess what? What text does he quote? Which piece of scripture does he hearken to when he is doing this? And as he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers'?" It is this text "For my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." Everybody's welcome. It's rather remarkable that this is on his mind. It's a text which is significant in speaking about the grace of God for us all, and maybe especially for a category that have identity issues that God sees and feels their plight. The eunuchs. So this is the continuation of that quote. "He was led like a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. In his humiliation, he was deprived of justice. Who can speak of his descendants?" I'm ahead of myself here. This is a text that is being quoted from a few chapters earlier, in chapter 53 of Isaiah. Is it 53? I don't know. But in any case, where, yes, in Acts 33. Here. Let's first go to the eunuch called, baptized by Philip. So there's a eunuch that is known as the Ethiopian eunuch. Here depicted as a black man. Not so sure whether the depiction Ethiopian is completely accurate. It's the Old Testament text refers to basically a black guy. Philip and the Ethiopian. Let's read this, and then we'll jump back to the previous slide. I got the slides, jostled. Now, an angel of, this is chapter 8 of Acts. starting verse 26. An angel of the Lord said to Philip, go south to the road, the desert road, that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. So he started out, and on his way, he met an Ethiopian eunuch, an important official in charge of all the treasury of the Kandake, which means Queen of Ethiopians. This man had gone to Jerusalem to worship, and on his way home was sitting in his chariot reading the book of Isaiah the prophet. Now, one can say, this eunuch has made a massive journey to come and pay his respects to the Lord. You might say he's one of those that takes God seriously. And on his way home, he was sitting in his chariot reading the book of Isaiah the prophet. The Spirit told Philip, go to that chariot, stay near it. Then Philip ran up to the chariot and heard the man reading Isaiah the prophet. Do you understand what you're reading? Philip asked. How can I? He said, unless someone explains it to me. So he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. This is the passage of scripture the eunuch was reading. He was led like a sheep to the slaughter. That's the text I had just now. And as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. In his humiliation, and this is messianic prophecy, in his humiliation he was deprived of justice. Who can speak of his descendants? Now this little detail about our Lord Jesus Christ, that he too was not going to have biological offspring, descendants, makes this passage hugely relevant to the life of this eunuch. For his life was taken from the earth. And this is just three chapters before the chapter that we've been looking at. This is Isaiah 53, verse 7 and 8, which is being quoted with these words. And so this part of Isaiah, these few chapters, have an awful lot that can mean an awful lot to somebody who's a eunuch. And it's interesting that Jesus also is a man who lives his life but does not get to express or exercise his sexuality. And a lot of modern people have found that complicated. They've made movies like Jesus Christ Superstar about him. Mm-hmm. Sort of fantasizing some details because it seems so not average for humans. This prophecy about Jesus is one which I think the eunuch correctly resonated with. And, this part of Acts is very remarkable. It's eight chapters later before we get in chapter 16, verse 9, the reference to a European involvement with the gospel. During the night, Paul had a vision of a man of Macedonia standing and begging him, come over to Macedonia and help us. For Africans, this is a very important little piece of history in Acts 8. It's a proof that they were standing first in line, early partakers in the gospel being spread to them. It's a text that has a lot of emotional import. The gospel being relevant for them. But it's double interesting that this very important reference to an ethnicity also is one to a specific guy who was a eunuch with his specific challenge in terms of his gendered existence. And I think it's a special mercy that we see in the Bible that this is given such an important place, such an uncomplicated embrace. That is precisely, you know, this region of Isaiah, where we have both the reference to the nature of Christ's experience on earth and his own, let's say, not full expression of sexuality, and these magnificent promises of a name and a guarantee for an identity into the future. It's a remarkable piece of history. I want to quote, before I move to my last thought, to quote a little passage from Mark Jarhouse's book, Understanding Gender Dysphoria. It's also well worth a read. I had the privilege of interacting with Mark Jarhouse when he was visiting the Netherlands last year. If anything, he is very compassionately involved with trying to come alongside people who are battling and wrestling transgender issues at this moment in history. He writes about the way we think about the differences between men and women. A lot of the debate in Christian circles has often been trying to figure out and parse exactly what are the differences between men and women so that we can have that nicely, clearly defined. And he writes, I think, something which is right on cue, that maybe this kind of attempt to create caricature categories or you know, clearly defined categories, that it is part of the problem and not part of the solution. I'll read him. But many differences between men and women are not categorical. Rather, they are better viewed as two bell-shaped curves, in which the average experiences of men and the average, average experiences of women are different, while having considerable overlap, either in ability or with reference to a characteristic. Indeed, all the research on gender differences in various personality traits, cognitive abilities, and preferences consistently shows that even when there are statistically significant differences between men and women, these differences pale in magnitude beside the variations among women on the one side and amongst men. So the difference between one man and another man can be very great, just as the difference between one woman and another woman can be very great. And for us to be trying to, like, for some sense of security, cut this down and say, this is what a woman is supposed to be doing, thinking, looking, etc., like, it's putting people in a straitjacket, which can be very damaging to them. And there's a paradox here. You can be in, let's say, extra-conservative Christian settings, and feel like there's all sorts of don't touch, don't do things that have to do with your gender that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to be a robust, slightly adrenaline junkie if you're a woman. You're not, etc. There are all sorts of things that don't fit in a cookie cutter definition of what it is to be a woman or a man. And then you get into that liberal college where you were studying gender studies and you express some quote-unquote boyish sentiments, and with a similar narrow definition, somebody says to you, well, you must be transgender. Yeah. You don't fit inside the cookie-cutter model of what it is to be a man or a woman in our perspective. Mm-hmm. And here's the paradox, that both sides of this, both extremes, are trying to clip the wings of what it is to be a man and a woman in a very unhelpful way. Such narrow definitions of what it is to be female or male that virtually all of us fall short of the ideal or the prototype. Yeah, he says it's rather artificial to focus on the differences between men and women and may unnecessarily create a false dichotomy through such narrow definitions of what it is to be female or male, that virtually all of us fall short of the ideal or the prototype. I think he's right on target when he identifies this tendency to want to narrow the definition of what it is to be male or female for the sake of trying to resolve our disquiet with the whole gender topic. Well, it's a wrong-headed response. I think we do much better to take biological givens seriously, just simply accept their compelling place in getting to establish who we are and what's out there. And at the same time, to hold back on trying to define what it's supposed to look and feel like to be a man or a woman. Because we're apparently getting it wrong for an awful lot of people. And I'm going to close with a few reflections on Genesis 2. If you look at the two categories, man and woman, men and women, we come across these in the creation narrative, chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis. And in chapter 2, verse 20 and on, we read the following: "But for Adam, no suitable helper was found." It's an interesting term. It's a very positive term. One who would be helpful to Adam. No suitable helper was found. So the Lord caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and then closed up the place with flesh. Then the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. Now, it's really interesting. The significance of this process was not lost on man. We get the first poem in history. The man said, "Now, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Same as me. She's like me." That's the first. "She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. The emphasis here is on the likeness. And at the same time, it's clear that there is this complementarity thing where the woman that God provides for man, he could have provided another man. You know, that God chooses here to do it in a gendered way with different types, man and woman. And so we get this complementarity, and then there's some consequences for how that moves forward. That is why, because of this history, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. Now, this footnote is important. We don't live in that situation anymore. We are not naked without any shame. We're in a messy world, the one I was just talking about. Very messy world. So we've fallen away from this context. But this introduction of the woman, where the first thing that is legitimately said is that we're of the same bones and the same flesh. And yet, this complementarity thing, the ability to become a new unit and to become one flesh, It's a graphic image of being designed in such a way that sexual union is possible. And it definitely does seem to speak to the way that the given created order is brought to us. Now, we need to be cognizant of how far, you know, the created order is out of whack. I just referenced Adam and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. There are a lot of people who have conditions, genetic conditions, that one might call intersex. People have all sorts of chromosomal variations. Klinefelter syndrome, XXY chromosomes. I could mention a number of others where the impact on genitalia, body plan, are not average, are different. Maybe having genitalia of both genders or sexes. The Bible sees the category of people who don't fit into the average mold of male and female. Especially in terms of the potential that maleness and femaleness has to procreate, as is articulated here. And the Bible has a clear signal of understanding how complicated that can be, given the magnitude of the promise. And basically God comes alongside the eunuchs, the category we're talking about in the biblical sense here, and says to them, I see you, and I see your plight, but don't worry, I've got your back. And so, rather than trying to find salvation in the here and now, by playing a game of pretend in whichever direction, I'm going to make sure that you have a guaranteed identity into the future and that you have all that comes with the sense of having offspring in the future. I'll guarantee that. And I'm going to make that a sacred thing. I'm going to bring that into my temple. I'm going to consecrate it inside the walls of my sanctuary. And it's a promise which is very far-reaching, but it does ask of us that we have a perspective on eternity, a perspective on a long-ended future. If you don't have that, this is a hollow promise. This is a promise which gains luster inasmuch as we have some sense of that deep and wonderful future. And this is actually a truth which is necessary, not just for people who wrestle with gender identity or something like that, but for all of us. Thank you.